Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Brexit paralysis moving from fiasco to fury and anger in the streets, with 2 weeks remaining in the extended deadline from March the 29th to April the 12th, and no apparent solution to avoid crashing out of the EU without any clear idea of what the hard landing will entail, short of an immediate 10% hit to the UK's GDP. Joining us from the UK is Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian, where she has an article, Farewell to the Worst Prime Minister Bar None, Until the Next One. We will discuss the politics of Einstein's definition of insanity in doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, and Prime Minister May's delusional resignation speech in which she promised, quote, as we leave the EU, we will forge a new, bold, positive role for ourselves in the world. However, the reality is she is leaving the UK closer to breaking apart while ignoring the country's majority who would now vote to remain as she pursues the illusion of Tory party unity. We will assess what options are possible in such a short time frame, such as a do-over vote which has been floated for some time and a new election which now appears to be in the cards, but that will require another extension of the deadline by the EU since a snap election would not be possible before the April 12th deadline. Then we'll go to Mexico City to gauge the local reaction to President Trump's threat to close the U.S. border with Mexico sometime in the coming week. Laura Carlson, the director of the Mexico-based Americas program at the Center for International Policy, who blogs at americas.org, joins us to discuss Trump's counterproductive and counterintuitive move of cutting off aid to the Central American countries from which the migrants are fleeing north, and how Mexico's new president is handling Trump's threat to Mexico's sovereignty when it comes to their own immigration policies. Then finally, we will speak with Laurie Brand, Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California and author of Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria, about the standoff in Algeria between the people and the government, which has been perpetrating a hoax since 2013 when President Bouteflika had a stroke, after which the Army's Chief of Staff, General Saleh, has been running the show from behind the scenes, pretending that Bouteflika was somehow governing. Now, due to mounting pressure after weeks of demonstrations, Saleh is calling for Bouteflika to be declared unfit for office, but the protesters are not buying it. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from the UK is Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly the BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and Associate Editor of The Independent and co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. She is the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All, and the latest article at The Guardian is Farewell to the Worst Prime Ministers, Bar None, Until the Next One. Welcome to Background Briefing, Polly Toynbee.
Hello.
So has the mood in the UK sort of shifted from fiasco to fatalism?
No, I think there's an awful lot of anger. You couldn't really call it fatalism. I think amongst most people, incomprehension about how on earth we've got to a place where Parliament can't agree on anything. I think there's quite a strong feeling amongst people who voted to leave the EU. Well, we voted to leave, so why don't they just do it? And an unwillingness amongst a lot of those people to engage with the complexity, because they were never told it was going to be a nightmare to do, of the different ways in which you might leave. You know, we put our X on the ballot paper for leave, that's it. But nothing on the ballot paper ever said, what kind of leave do you mean?
And this is manifested in demonstrations and counter-demonstrations.
Well, there was a huge demonstration to have another referendum of an estimated million people, which is enormous for London, for England. Much smaller demonstrations on the day we should have left, on March the 29th, by two different groups leave groups, one slightly more fascistic, the other one more conventional right-wing politics, who sort of clashed outside the House of Commons, but many fewer of them, but very angry. And they do reflect a strong strand of opinion in this country, though no longer the majority, because all of the polls, for every single poll for the over a year, and there have been many, has shown that people would now vote Remain by a margin of probably about 8% ahead for Remain, which is a big margin considering it was 4% behind last time.
But the March 29 deadline was passed. The EU gave the UK an extension till April the 12th. That's not a lot. That's about 2 weeks. Is there anything that can be done? I mean, there's now, you talked about a do-over, which seems logical. I don't know why it can't be done, but I'm sure you can explain that. Or at least I hope you can. And secondly, well, isn't there some talk about a new snap election?
A snap election is a possibility, but it I don't think it's a very popular one with the Conservative Party, because they have a leader they're trying to get rid of and who promises she'll go if they will only vote for her withdrawal from the EU plan, which not enough people in her party will vote for. But if they want to get rid of her, they should vote for it, and then they can choose a new leader. A general election looks like not the obvious solution, because I think enough people in her party would think that their party would do very badly, and so they will try not to do that. I mean, the most simple answer, which might get a majority, but she refuses to countenance, is to, for the Labour Party, say they would accept her deal, they'd nod it through, maybe abstain, they'd nod it through, let it go through, on condition it was put back to the people in a referendum, saying you have to confirm, the people have to confirm this deal is acceptable to them, in which case we'll accept that. And I would have thought that was her best way out of it, but she has had many red lines, and some of them she's already crossed. One of them is, I will not have another referendum. So we wait to see who gives way first in a very frightening situation.
Well, it does seem that Theresa May is practicing the politics of what Einstein referred to as a definition of insanity, when you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Her resignation offer was sort of delusional. You quoted in your article, Polly Toynbee, she says, as we leave the EU, we will forge a new, bold, positive role for ourselves in the world. Well, apparently the crashing out is going to take 10% off the GDP right off the top. That's not a bold, positive...
No, she's not for crashing out. She wasn't suggesting that.
Right.
It's interesting that... I suspect that is her only really hard red line, unless she has taken leave of her senses. As Prime Minister, she has seen all of the documents, all of the evidence. As you say, 10% drop in GDP, that's only a small part of what would hit us on the day we crashed out. We would be breaking an international treaty with Ireland, a treaty that's backed up by the EU. There would be an immediate hard border in Ireland, which breaks the Good Friday Agreement, which first John Major and then the previous Conservative Prime Minister and then Tony Blair forged with great care and has brought peace to Ireland. We would break that if we crash out, and there would have to be a border. And that border would be policed, and it would be very dangerous, and it would ignite again a lot of the old passions that have been more or less put to bed in the last 20 years. So I don't think she will do that. She threatens that that's what might happen, because, of course, if no agreement is passed, that is the default position in law. Unless something else is done, on the 12th of April, we will crash out. There will be a real barrier across the Channel where huge amounts of our goods flow to and from each way. Some of our supermarket shelves will be empty. There will be panic buying. Some medicines that we rely on from Europe will not get here. And some very sick people won't get medicines they really need. I mean, there is a long list of disastrous consequences. And she has seen all of those. She has studied all of those papers and documents. And I think that that's the one thing she won't do. Now, if we get right up to the 11th hour, in 11 o'clock before the stroke of midnight on the 12th of April, one thing she can do is she can go back to Europe and say, we need a longer extension. And it looks as if they would give it, but it would have to be a very long one. It would they would probably give a year. Now, that means we would have to fight the European elections. It's a very inconvenient fact that in May, right across Europe, 100 million people, there will be European elections. And if we are to stay in for a year, we have to have candidates and fight an election we weren't expecting to fight. And nobody quite knows how those elections will turn out, whether they would be used as a revenge against Parliament, whether it would bring in a lot of quite right-wing forces or not, or whether perhaps Remainers would establish their precedents and we'd get a lot of Remain-minded new European members of the European Parliament. But that's one thing she can do, and she alone can do it. She can press that button, she can go to Europe, and I think they would grant it to her, which is why I think we won't crash out, because that is one option. Another option she has, which is the nuclear option, is that she can press the button all on her own to revoke the our request to leave Europe. And again, on the 11th hour, she could do that. She'll say, we've changed our mind. We're not going to leave after all. We're staying as you were. Leave things as they are. I mean, there would be outcry at that because we have had a referendum, and to simply ignore it and set it aside would be a very dangerous thing to do politically. But she has the power to do that too. Or perhaps her MPs, seeing that those are two options, neither of which they like at all, will finally knuckle under. More and more of them have voted for her each time, and next time, with gritted teeth, agree to vote for her deal, though it doesn't look that way at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Polly Toynbee, who's in the UK. She's a columnist for The Guardian, who was formerly BBC social affairs editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. And she's the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is Farewell to the Worst Prime Minister, Bar None, Until the Next One. Well, the European elections that you mentioned for the European Parliament in May, of course, ironically, what is going on behind the scenes there is that the same person who's the only person that's a beneficiary so far of the paralysis in the UK as a result of the Brexit vote is Vladimir Putin. He's financing all kinds of right-wing and far-right-wing parties in Western Europe in the hope that they will reach a one-third threshold to be sort of spoilers and paralyze the European government. And of all allies that Putin has in this, of course, is Stephen Bannon, who's working tirelessly to bring that about.
Yes, indeed. I think all of Europe is quite trepidatious about how these elections are going to pan out and whether the right-wing forces, I mean, each country has mostly a small right-wing group, apart from Poland and Hungary, where the right-wing are in power, Austria to some extent. Other countries, you know, France has Le Pen, Angela Merkel has the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, and these right-wing groups do very well in these elections because they're a kind of free-hit election, because nobody takes them terribly seriously. You're sending an MEP miles away to a parliament which is not that much reported, certainly not in this country, this anti-European country, and it's not your local MP for your government. So for people who have extremist tendencies, it's a free hit. It usually has quite a low turnout. Not many people care very much, which makes it prime territory for extremists of all kinds. So it is a very risky time for Europe. And as you say, Vladimir Putin and the underground world of internet influencing is hard at work with Steve Bannon and others, and lots of money swashing around to try to destroy Europe. I mean, Putin doesn't really mind in what form it's destroyed, but he wants it destroyed, and the best weapon to hand is the far right.
And if you get to the one-third threshold, you have veto power, I understand, and that certainly, to buttress what you just said, Polly Toynbee, isn't Nigel Farage a member of the European Parliament, but not of the UK Parliament, even though he's behind, he's the guy that basically put forth Brexit?
well, he's one of them.
One of them.
He's by no means the most important one, but he's somebody who's made his name. He's stood for Parliament here 6 times and failed, but he's managed to make it through a proportional representation system. I mean, like you, we have a first-past-the-post system for domestic elections, but for the European elections, it's a proportional system. So you only have to reach a fairly low threshold to get some people from fringe parties into that Parliament, which is why it's a better chance for more extreme parties. He's quite likely to get re-elected. He has been, UKIP, his party, the United Kingdom Independence Party, got the most members this time 4 years ago, which was very shocking and a great embarrassment to us, that we sent a lot of ignoramuses, people who had no knowledge of politics, let alone of Europe, to be abusive in the European Parliament, to be incredibly rude to officials, to politicians there, a real embarrassment as a representation of this country. And it may well happen again. On the other hand, it just possibly may not. I mean, maybe the Remainers will get it together to get out the vote, to vote for moderates of either Labour or Conservative, pro-Remain people.
Well, obviously, one of the great ironies, again, is that just only a couple of days after Donald Trump was elected, in the transition in Trump Tower, among the first visitors were Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks, the so-called insurance magnate whose Russian wife, Katya Podrina, is alleged to be a conduit for FSB money, because Banks was the biggest donor to the Leave campaign. And she, of course, Podrina, was essentially an FSB prostitute who was booted out of the Emirates. So there's a whole level of sleaze in this thing. It seems like a whole bunch of bottom feeders came forth. And as you mentioned, they lied to the public. They didn't tell them what the consequences of Leave were. Is any of those chickens coming home to roost?
Well, certainly they've been fined, not a very considerable fine, by the Electoral Commission here for misuse of funds and for lying about funds in the course of the campaign. But the Electoral Commission didn't think it had been enough to seriously affect the result. They were probably right about that. But nobody knows where Aaron Banks got the £8 million he donated to the Leave campaign. It's a murky and mysterious world. But the truth is, there's a large slice of the Conservative Party who are on that side too. So, I mean, it'd be a fairly marginal thing if it was just them.
Right.
But today, 170 Conservative members of Parliament wrote to Theresa May to say they want a no-deal crash out. They want to break the Good Friday Agreement, to set up a barrier across the Irish border. That is an astonishing number of people willing to do something that is illegal and dangerous and will have terrible consequences. The Conservative Party has itself been infiltrated to a large degree by people who would never have been Conservative, say, 20, 25 years ago. There has been a big move of extreme Brexiteers to join the party and to stand as candidates. As a result, I don't think hardly any moderate Conservatives have been selected as members of Parliament for the last 15 years. It's been impossible to be selected by a local party for a local constituency unless you are the most extreme hard Brexit person. And that has changed the nature and character of the party considerably. And it guarantees that as Theresa May steps down, which she certainly will by next December, whoever follows her will be a very hard Brexiteer, because nobody else could be elected as leader of the Conservative Party by the very small but very extreme members of the Conservative Party in the constituencies, who are the ones in the end who get to choose the next leader, and in this case, choose the next Prime Minister for us all, and we have no say.
Well, just in closing, Polly Toynbee, is there an analogy here, or at least a comparison, with what's happened to conservatism here in the United States? It's been captured by the far-right populist movement that Donald Trump represents. And, of course, Donald Trump got $5 to $6 billion worth of free advertising from the media in what was the Republican primaries were, in fact, a reality TV show where he knocked everybody off the island. But essentially, the Jeb Bushes of this world failed to stop him. And now traditional conservatives in the United States are an endangered species. Is that something similar happened there with these kind of private school boys, Etonian types like Cameron, who came up with this ridiculous Brexit thing in the first place? Is it their failure that has allowed these Brexiteers to seize the Conservative Party?
I think so. I think it's been going for a long time. It's been slowly creeping up, this Brexit idea that was at first regarded as very marginal and a fringe activity. I mean, as long ago as when John Major was Prime Minister, there were a handful of people who drove him crazy, but they were only a handful of the party, and they have just gradually grown and grown and grown. And as you say, in the traditional part of the Conservative Party has just failed to stop it happening. They've given in to them time and time again, each concession saying, well, this time this will appease them. Nothing appeases them. No Brexit will ever be hard enough for them. Nothing will be hard enough for them. So Cameron thought he would appease them by having a referendum that he was absolutely certain he would win. And, you know, he has appeased them all along. Cameron pulled the Conservatives out of the moderate Conservative group in the European Parliament, where, you know, the natural home for Conservatives would have been with Angela Merkel and the powerful Conservative groups in Europe, and created a new extreme little group, simply, again, to appease the extremists in his own party. And it was a crazy thing to do. So each time they give in to them, the far right wins and wins again. It's not exactly the same as the far right in the United States. It doesn't have a particularly socially conservative element. You know, it's not exercised by abortion issues or gay rights issues or things of that kind. It has a monomania about Europe. And into that goes the whole of what is it to be British? What is our identity? How do we rule the waves again? Fantasies of empire. If we could strike our own trade agreements, say with Donald Trump, with the Australians, we'd be great again and independent. It's all a nonsense. We will never come to a trade agreement with the Americans. It will be impossible. Donald Trump will make impossible demands that we won't be able to meet. But that's the fantasy. And I think it is a fantasy of a sort of recreate the old empire, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the white empire. And somehow that puts us back in the driving seat. What we'll find immediately we start negotiating is that we are the weakest of all of those when it comes to negotiating.
Well, Polly Toynbee, I thank you very much for joining us. I wish we had something positive to say, but I must say...
difficult.
Right.
We're going to go through a week of absolute hell, right, and probably then a year of absolute hell. And at the end of this, it's not the end still, because this is only phase one. We then have a long negotiating process of what exactly our relationship with Europe will be. And I think that's what people don't realise in this country. They think, get it over with, but it's never going to be over with.
Well, again, Polly Toynbee, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Polly Toynbee, who's a columnist for The Guardian, who is formerly BBC social affairs editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. And she's the co-author of Dismembered, How the Attack on the State Harms Us All. And her latest article at The Guardian is Farewell to the Worst Prime Minister, Bar None, Until the Next One. And we can take a brief station break, we're back and go to Mexico City to gauge the local reaction to President Trump's threat to close the U.S. border with Mexico sometime in the coming week.
London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania is Britain the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación. la población herida. México, 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 México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Laura Carlson, the director of the Mexico-based Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. In 1986, she received a Fulbright scholarship to study the impact of the Mexican economic crisis on women, has lived in Mexico City ever since, and she blogs at americas.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Carlson.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Laura, the president is doing something that it seems so counterintuitive, and that is he's breaking off foreign assistance programs to the Northern Triangle of countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And that's about $500 million in 2018 in funds, which, by the way, don't go government to government. They go mostly through NGOs so that the money actually gets to the ground. So the logical thing, if you've got a problem of people emigrating from these countries to the United States if in fear for their lives and in desperate need of employment, then it would make more sense to try and make a life more livable in these countries. And then, of course, on the other level, in terms of shutting down the border, he's basically threatening Mexico. Trump says if you don't stop them, meaning the so-called caravan, which, by the way, has a lot of Cubans in it, we're closing the border. We'll close it and we'll keep it closed for a long time. I'm not playing games. Mexico has to stop it. So what's the local reaction to this kind of bullying?
Well, let's take this threat to close the border first. Basically, what President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said was SAFO. And this is a term from a child's game that means safe. And he means that I'm not joining this game. He has said that he will not respond to threats. His Secretary of Foreign Relations has also said that Mexico will not respond to threats and that Mexico has its own sovereign migratory policy, just as it respects the migratory policy of the United States. So yesterday, President López Obrador did a consultation in a rally that he held in the state of Veracruz, and he asked the people present if they thought that he should fight with the United States or that he should act prudently. And, of course, everyone said that he should not respond to Trump. So far, that is the response from the Mexican government, that they are not going to respond to threats from Donald Trump, despite the fact that this started late Thursday and has been consistent through today with a fairly constant tweet storm of threats to close the border if Mexico doesn't stop the migrants and refugees, because we have to remember that a large number of these people coming up are actually refugees who have the international right to request asylum in the United States.
Well, one of the things that López Obrador apparently has tried to work on with Trump, and as you point out, he doesn't want to get sucked into a tweet storm, because I think it was George Bernard Shaw said, you don't wrestle with a pig because you end up getting dirty, and besides, the pig likes it. He's basically has floated the idea that Mexico could try and employ some of these people fleeing the chaos and dangers in Central America, employ them in Mexico, but that would require help from the U.S. government to support his plan. And apparently Trump has simply offered nothing in no response to López Obrador's suggestion.
That's right. That has been the response of Mexico, to say what we really have to do is go to the root causes of the migration that's coming up from particularly these three Central American countries, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, which is the violence and the extreme poverty that's forcing people to flee untenable situations in which they live. And part of that has been that they've offered work visas, they've offered asylum in the United States to people. And there's been no support so far or recognition of these kinds of programs. Now, it was in negotiations, supposedly, a plan to offer Mexico $10 billion to develop the southern part of Mexico and be able to increase the ability to absorb migrants coming up, as well as people from Mexico who might be forced to flee it by increasing employment there. Supposedly, this was being negotiated just several days ago. They were negotiating an aid package to Central America. So now we have this complete flip-flop. And it would seem that Donald Trump does not understand either foreign aid from the United States and its role in the rest of the world, or international commerce and what would actually happen to the United States if he closed the border with Mexico. He thinks this is this huge threat to Mexico, but you can imagine what the border states and much of the rest of the country, the famous avocado argument, you know, would say if that actually were come to pass. He'd clearly be shooting himself in the foot. When you started out, you talked about the aid package to, you know, cutting off the aid to these three countries in Central America because supposedly they have not done enough to keep their people from leaving the country, something which is usually associated with a totalitarian society. If you prohibit your own people from coming, you know, entering and leaving their country. And that also shows this complete misunderstanding of what U.S. foreign aid is. The majority, not only does it not go to the governments, but the majority of U.S. foreign aid stays in the United States. And the recent package that the Trump administration offered these Central America countries was essentially to crack down on borders. And most of it would go to defense companies and to intelligence companies in the United States to provide this equipment to train police and armies against their own people. That's why, ironically, the major human rights organizations in Honduras, they've been asking for years for the United States to cut off foreign aid to Honduras. And they represent a large number of communities, some of the poorest communities, some of the communities that are involved in the efforts to protest the kind of repressions that's coming from a corrupt and illegal government in the country of Honduras. So there's a number of contradictions here between this policy and his own policy just days ago, and also a complete lack of understanding of what the real impact would be.
And again, I'm speaking with Laura Carlson, who's the director of the Mexico-based Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. In 1986, she received the Fulbright Scholarship to study the impact of Mexican economic crisis on women and has lived in Mexico City ever since, and she blogs at americas.org. And apparently, there is total chaos in the State Department at the U.S. embassies in the countries involved, Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, because of Trump's sort of off-the-cuff governing. You know, it's just pathetic having to cover this stuff because America's governed by a reality TV showman, and it's just government by stunt. He just throws out stuff to keep everybody off balance, and this is yet another example. And he creates a crisis, and then he attempts to solve the very crisis that he created. So when you say there'll be chaos in the border, there surely will be. And then he'll, you know, say, I'm going to fix it. So that is, that's the MO, you know, and yeah. Only a sociopath could do this because he's absolutely devoid of any humanity and any sense of the human cost. He's actually, in many ways, Trump is actually quite sadistic.
Yeah, and we have to remember, Ian, too, that this whole crisis that's supposedly the origin of now the acute crisis of threatening to close off the border and throw relations with Mexico, not to mention $1.5 billion in international commerce a day, you know, into chaos, and then this other threat to cut off aid to Central America. The crisis behind that was invented by Donald Trump, too. Because it's a crisis of migration that doesn't really exist. There have been points in U.S. history where immigration and refugee flows over the borders have been higher than they are today. The people who are coming into the country are mostly desperate families who need to be attended to under their rights under international law. And then he says, well, our detention centers are full and we cannot continue with this situation and Mexico has to do something about it and Central America has to do something about it, when who has to do something about it is the United States government, which he ostensibly runs, in terms of processing with due process their refugee hearings and their rights and being able to attend to this population, you know, in desperate need in humanitarian terms.
Well, but that's not to say, Laura Carlson, that there isn't any coherence about a immigration policy. And if the Democrats had one, it would be certainly the time to put it forth, because there are people coming at the border and they are straining resources. And there is this double two-tiered situation. I'm an immigrant from Australia, but I did it by the book and did it by the law. And you know, it was a long process. But the idea that, you know, if people can wander across the border and become American citizens, then was I stupid to play by the rules? I mean, it's not, you know, it's obviously winning. Pardon?
These families are playing by the rules.
I understand the rules of asylum, but right. It's choking up the resources, and obviously they're cutting off the resources. My sense is, though, and you're in Mexico City, is that the best way to solve this problem is to make life more livable for people in these countries so they don't have to emigrate. And my understanding is that Mexicans, in spite of Trump's demonizing of them, they would prefer to live in Mexico. Is that true?
Well, yeah. I mean, now if you look at the migration flows, there's net zero for Mexico, which doesn't mean that some people are still migrating to the United States. But it's been a complete change in terms of migration now being not Mexican, but Central American. And even the families, the Central American families that are coming up, they would not choose to make such a difficult and dangerous journey, especially with their children, if they weren't facing, you know, a situation that they could no longer feel safe in at home. They would rather stay home too. But they've got a combination of factors, many of which have been caused by U.S. policies in the past that include displacement from communities because of transnational investment in mega projects. They include the level of violence that exists because of political crises where, you know, corruption has been allowed to continue and a political elite has controlled a country in undemocratic terms for years, going back to the dirty wars and military dictatorships. There's a whole series of factors there, and the reason that they still exist and the reason that they've come to a head and forced these families to flee is that it's not a question of how much foreign aid is being given, but a question of how it's being given and what it's being given to. And much of what USAID has been going to for decades is to the same factors that exacerbate immigration. So it takes a cool and steady look at the strategies for foreign aid instead of just the amounts in order to be able to really address the root causes.
So in other words, U.S. foreign aid hasn't changed since the dirty wars in the sense that we've been propping up corrupt dictatorships, and we're doing it to this very day in Honduras for sure, and turning a blind eye to what's happening in Guatemala and I guess in El Salvador, the street gangs, which by the way were created here in Los Angeles, the 18th Street and MS-13, they were a result of the U.S. intervention during that period. So we're still actually creating the very same problem, and what aid we give perpetuates that. It goes to the wrong people. So what we need is to focus on humanitarian aid, human rights, and economic assistance to the peoples of these countries, not the crooked governments. Is that a summary?
Yes. And so the optimistic part of it is, if bad policies over the years have created this crisis, then changing policies, good policies, can resolve the crisis. You know, it's not something that it's become the new normal, but it doesn't have to be the new normal. You know, we can start taking a real look at what's happening and caring about the people themselves and listening to the people themselves and begin to have a different strategy toward all this that doesn't create more hatred, more racism, more conflict, you know, terrible relations with our closest neighbor, the United States' closest neighbor here in Mexico. Here you can imagine how people are feeling. There's 1.5 million U.S. citizens that live in Mexico, and they're feeling like, what's going on in this relationship between these two countries that are mine? It's really, again, a crisis of our own making. Our own making being people in Washington,
and a president who thrives on manufacturing crises because he's incapable of actually governing. So I would say that's the root cause.
And he has some very, very serious accusations against him, even though the Mueller report is now out.
No, it's not. It's only a four-page summary. Don't fall for that,
right,
Laura.
Right. Very important declaration.
Right. Well, look, I appreciate you joining us, and let's stay in touch. And I'm grateful for your telling us what's happening in your side of the border down there in Mexico City.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. I look forward to it.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Carlson, who's the director of the Mexico-based America's Program at the Center for International Policy. In 1986, she received a Fulbright scholarship to study the impact of the Mexican economic crisis on women and has lived in Mexico City ever since, and she blogs at americas.org. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the hoax that's been perpetrated in Algeria since 2013, when President Bouteflika had a stroke, after which the Army's Chief of Staff, General Salah, has been running the show from behind the scenes, pretending that Bouteflika was somehow governing.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Laurie Brand, who's the Robert Granford Wright Professor and Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. She's a past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America and chair of its Committee on Academic Freedom since 2006, and she specializes in Middle East international relations and inter-Arab politics, and her books include Citizens Abroad, States and Migration in the Middle East and North Africa, and Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Brand.
Good morning, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Laurie. And I guess what's been going on for some time, for many weeks now, are protests and growing demonstrations and an enormous amount of activity on social media in Algeria demanding the end of the Bouteflika's 20-year rule. But in 2013, he had a stroke, which apparently incapacitated him. He's 82 years old now. He hasn't been seen in public. And behind the scenes, the Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Ahmed Gayed Salah, has actually been running the country. And now he's rather disingenuously saying that that Bouteflika should be declared unfit for office. But I don't think the protesters are buying it, are they?
No, they're not. They've made very clear, I think, what the regime has been trying to do over the last, since February, actually, the last part of February, is make what are minor, I mean, one could call them concessions, but actually I think it's more like an attempt at a sleight of the hand to try and either trick the people who have, increasingly been participating in these demonstrations or defecting from various political parties, members of non-governmental organizations that have also come out against against the government. What the regime has been trying to do is to provide sort of small changes to what would otherwise be the prospects of another term for Bouteflika. And each time they offer something, there are more people who go out in the street, and there are more defections, and people are basically saying, you don't get it. Leave means leave. Literally, that's what is on some of these posters, or banners and placards that people have been carrying in these demonstrations. And so I think it shows two things, at least, and that is, one, the complete disarray or the complete inability of the clans that have been in effect running Algeria for the last several decades, and also this incredible, what I would call sort of scorn for or disrespect for, it's not a surprise, I guess, for average Algerians, to think that average Algerians, given what they've suffered under this this regime, would be so sort of naive as to accept the kinds of crumbs that they're being thrown is really to, I think, substantially underestimate people's understanding of the government, even if what's called the pouvoir, which is the word that's generally used to refer to those who are governing Algeria behind the scenes, people may not understand exactly what the balance of forces is there and exactly who's pulling the strings, but they have a fairly good idea, and they know that their votes don't mean much. And so they are savvy enough to not be taken in by any of these maneuvers, these attempts by various members of the regime to try and either divide the public or to suggest to them that there's a way out through a continuation of the many of the same actors who are currently in place.
So pouvoir, the tip, is that what it
I'm sorry?
I thought pouvoir, does that mean like a tip? Is that what they're talking about?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Well, I thought I've got the French wrong, but I thought it was like, you know, they say in restaurants, it's service is not understood.
Pouvoir instead of pouvoir, yes.
Yeah, pouvoir.
Yes, it's a play on you.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. Laurie Brand again, the Robert Granford Wright Professor and Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California, whose latest book is Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. I think for the context, though, you have to go back to the bloody civil war in Algeria against the FIS, the Islamists, that cost about at least 200,000 lives. And once all that fratricide ended in the 2000s, that's when Bouteflika sort of, he came back, did he not? And then, as I mentioned, in 2013, he suffered a stroke. But so is the military, as has been reported in a lot of stories covering this, these protests in Algeria, which aren't getting that much attention, that's why I wanted to cover it today.
Mm-hmm.
Is the military a revered institution, having endured all that fratricide?
Yes, the military did endure. And I think you're right to point out that in order to understand where we are today, it's important to go back a bit farther. Yes, in Bouteflika, I mean, one of the elements of his legitimacy when he ran for the presidency in 1999 was precisely the fact that he was one of the few remaining members of the leadership that could political personalities, I guess, who could claim legitimacy for his participation in the in the revolution. And then he also served as foreign minister in the first post-revolutionary government, and then also he managed to stay on. In fact, some people argue that the reason that Boumediene, who overthrew Algeria's first president, Ahmed Ben Bella, that Ben Bella's dismissal of Bouteflika was one of the reasons behind Boumediene's moving against Ben Bella. In any case, so he does have that. He did have that legitimacy of having served early in the period immediately following the revolution. During the 1990s, as you pointed out, there was this dreadful period of insurgency. Some people call it a civil war, but in any case, which did tremendous damage, tremendous loss of life. People who, intellectuals and other sort of leaders who were either killed or fled Algeria. And it was finally brought to an end in the early 2000s. It was a process that was set in motion by Bouteflika's predecessor, Lamine Zerwell. But Bouteflika came into power. He was elected in 1999. It's probably worth pointing out at that point that originally looked like it was going to be a multi-candidate election, but most of the other candidates pulled out when they felt it became clear that he really was the Army's candidate and that the Army would pull the strings behind the scenes to make sure that he won. So they anticipated electoral fraud and therefore decided not to participate. But anyway, Bouteflika won, and he then saw the country through the sort of the final stages of a reconciliation of sorts, or at least an ending of the this civil war. Now, there were many people who were unhappy with certain aspects of that that arrangement that was put in place, because they felt that he had made too many concessions to people who had been engaged in bloody violence during the civil war. But in any case, I think he was therefore credited with having brought this period to an end, even if some people did dissent about what its content and shape was. But he also, it was 2008, I mean, originally when he became president, there was a two-term limit, according to the Constitution. But in 2008, he oversaw the revision of the Constitution, which removed the term limits. So he was set in that case. And so, as you pointed out, in 2013, he had a stroke. And at that point, I think most people thought that, his political, future was over, that he wouldn't be running for office. But in fact, he was put up for office again. And it was, it was fairly clear at that point that he really wasn't, he didn't have the capacity to run the government. And in fact, when he took the oath of office, he could barely take the oath of office. And then since then, he's rarely been seen in public, and certainly rarely seen actually talking, certainly not live in public. So this sort of mise en scène by these different clans that have been increasingly running Algeria was that they have this sort of puppet who, nobody in their right mind believes that he's taking the decisions or he's making the decisions. And yet, because the clans themselves are unable to come to an agreement on who his successor should be, it's like, kicking the can down the road. Now, your question initially was about the military, and the military has continued to be an extremely important actor in all of this. There were claims, and I think well-established claims, against the military for the role that it and some people probably acting in its name played during the 1990s. This was a dirty war on sort of all or both sides, but it ultimately emerges as a strong institution because the regime itself was able to survive that period. And behind the scenes, it continued to be. It had been the power broker when Boumediene died in 1978 in the choice of Shadli Ben Jadid, who was again he emerged out as the military's choice when the other sort of groups behind the scene were unable to come to consensus on a candidate. So this is a role the military has played before, and now the question is, the current Army Chief of Staff has been a supporter of Bouteflika. He supported the idea of Bouteflika's candidacy again when it was proposed this last time. But then his support has gradually waned until he, earlier this past week, I guess, proclaimed that the Article 102 of the Algerian Constitution should be invoked. And this is, sort of like the equivalent of the 25th
Amendment, yeah.
Constitution. Roughly. This is, I'm sure constitutional scholars would not agree. They would find a problem with my making that analogy. But in any case, what it does is it basically sort of, it doesn't remove a president from office exactly. It sort of gives a period of transition when the country is to be ruled by another institution, but then if the president is able to return to his functions after, I think the first one is 45 days, then he returns to his functions. If not, there can be an extension of another 90 days. So in other words, the invocation of that is not like saying, okay, Bouteflika will be removed tomorrow. And in fact, there's also a very sort of complex process built into the Constitution to govern how somebody would be removed. So there are, I mean, there are two basic points of opposition to Bouteflika's continuing. I mean, one is that the people have basically said we're not going to be deceived by any additional attempts to sort of smooth over what needs to be not just a transition at the very top, but what needs to be a much deeper reform or revolution in sorts of the regime. But also the fact that Bouteflika has been there's nothing really much new about the condition of his health. Right. So that triggers the question, why haven't these groups that would be required to certify him incapable of continuing, why haven't they done so before? So anyway, that's sort of where we are now. And I guess it was just yesterday the Army Chief of Staff made a statement which went a step farther. So some people view this as a qualitative, I guess, change in the way that the Army has been reacting, and also in terms of the possibility of setting up some sort of a confrontation down the road. So while he's been proclaiming the unity of the people in the Army, we heard that, you know, in the Egyptian revolution back in 2011, he's now said that in addition to Article 102, that Article 7 and 8 of the Constitution need to be invoked. Both of those articles deal with the sovereignty of the people and the right of the people to make decisions. So it's not clear exactly what that would mean in practice, but it's clear that the Army, I mean, he made this proclamation in front of a meeting with a lot of other high-ranking military people. So I think further, at least sort of visually or symbolically demonstrating the role that the Army sees for itself, I guess, in playing in this this transition.
Well, we've run out of time, but obviously there are still a lot of younger officers who don't like Asala's being so corrupt. And by the way, we have to remind ourselves that we had a president who was incapacitated for at least a year, Woodrow Wilson. But this guy's been a vegetable for, 6 years? So the whole thing is pretty surreal.
Yes, it is surreal.
I thank you so much for joining us, Laurie Brand.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Laurie Brand, who's the Robert Granford Wright Professor and Professor of International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California, and her latest book is Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.